really happy today to have Carrie as our speaker. Carrie Lee is the director of the Juvenile Justice Center at Barry in Orlando. She is a co-worker of Jerry Glenn's. Carrie really has dedicated her legal career to public interest work and has worked at the, started even at the age of 18 working in the public defender's office. She's been not only, then she obviously went on and got her law degree and worked as a public defender, but she's also been very involved with children in the dependency system and even spent a year working for the Department of Children and Families. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Carrie. She has provided some presentation for you guys to follow along that was sent out yesterday with the email with all the call-in information. Okay, thanks a lot, Carrie. I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you, Mary Kay. I really appreciate it, and I'm honored to be talking with all of you at this time. And yes, I did manage to survive working for the Department of Children and Families for a year, but I missed, working with the kids. I ended up back at the public defender's office, but I gained invaluable knowledge and experience on the dependency side, and was able to really help me on the delinquency side as a public defender representing kids. I just kind of want to give you some brief background about the juvenile delinquency process, and then I want to include, while I'm going through, kind of some, critical issues that may come up that do involve the guardian ad litem office and how you can, assist. And I think that, the relationship between, we all want to do what's best for these kids. And especially the kids that are the crossover kids that are in both the dependency and delinquency, these are the kids that are really suffering. And, I'm preaching to the choir, but as these are the kids that have truly, really have been traumatized. And not only are they being traumatized because of, why they're in the dependency system, but they're also facing additional trauma while going through the delinquency process. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. When a child is arrested, they are taken to what's called a juvenile assessment center. And throughout the state of Florida, some circuits have juvenile assessment centers, some don't. Some may have one in just one county, and all the outlying counties, the kids are brought to the juvenile assessment center when they're arrested. At that time, when they're at the juvenile assessment center, the child is then determined whether they need to be released or whether they score detention. The rules for juvenile procedure in the delinquency system as well, I think for the dependency as well, is very strict. And in the delinquency side, we are able to really, it's kind of such a niche field that a lot of criminal defense attorneys that normally handle adults come to the delinquency system and don't understand the processes. Children don't get bonds. Delinquency, the rules of following delinquency is very statutory in nature, and a lot of them, think that they can argue the same conditions of, release that would normally work for an adult does not work for a juvenile. And so when these children are brought into the juvenile assessment centers, they're screened. And it's really important for, I think already, maybe it said this, it's really important if the guardian ad litem can be involved in this process to be involved and let the juvenile defenders know any kind of critical, issues the child has, whether it's their educational or mental health needs. A lot of times, unfortunately, there is a breakdown between the juvenile defenders and the guardian ad litem and the caseworker as to what's really going on with the children. And I think that, the guardians are just an invaluable resource for the juvenile defenders. And once the child is brought, then they conduct a risk assessment. They determine whether the child does score release. If the child scores release, it should be between 0 and 6 points. meaning they get straight release. Now, sometimes the child can be placed on conditions such as no return to the scene or no contact with the co-defendants or the victims, and that's okay. However, there is case law that says that a lot of the courts try to implement what's called a behavior order, where it's you must go to school every day, you must follow, you know, parent or guardian or foster parent or foster guardian's rules of the household. And there's now been case law saying that that's not acceptable and that is not within the rules of juvenile procedure and the Florida statutes. And so those kind of conditions cannot be put in place on the child. If the child scores between 7 and 11 points, they score what's called home detention. Home detention is a contract that's given to the child. They return to court the next day, and they're placed again on home detention by the court. And the court says you must be at home at all times, other than going to school. That even means if mom or dad or foster parent or, you know, or guardian wants to take the child out, even under the direct supervision, that's not acceptable. The child must remain at home at all times during that period of home detention, which is usually 21 days. If the child scores 12 points or more, the child scores secure detention, meaning that they're then detained at the juvenile detention center, and usually it's for 21 days. If they are detained at the juvenile assessment center, they must be seen by a judge within 24 hours. That's not happening a lot of, in fact, I think that I know of, the only circuit that does follow this requirement is Miami. And they have their detention hearings twice a day to comply with this rule. The child is supposed to be seen within 24 hours. So meaning if they're coming in, you know, even if it's early in the day at 3, they need to be seen that next morning, and that may not be happening. And so that's something we've talked with our defenders about and educating them, but that's something that you should know as well, that the child must be seen, just like an adult, the initial parents, the child or adult must see a judge within 24 hours of their arrest. The risk assessment is a kind of tricky tool that really is kind of has to be, you know, in front of you and go over in thorough detail, which I don't have. I mean, we've lectured our defenders, you know, several hours at a time on following the risk assessment and learning all about the risk assessments. And it's kind of a tricky little tool that's being used. So I'm not going to go into great detail about it, but it is an important instrument, and it is by statute it's created. And it's created so the judges don't have that opportunity to make individualized variations from child to child. We all have repeat customers. Some of my favorite clients were my repeat customers. And I think that the judges sometimes take it personally when the child is brought back over and over again and may be wanting to detain the child, but they don't score detention. And so because of this risk assessment, this is preventing that kind of individualized, you know, opinion on the child and creating court, you know, a non-biased, non-prejudicial automated kind of criteria. The other thing that is part of the risk assessment is called the face sheet. And on the face sheet, it includes the child's background, including who their parent is, who the foster parent is, what's their current phone information, where they're living. And I think that that's something that the guardians can also be a great assistance to the juvenile defenders to, you know, be able to come to court if you are involved early in the process and making sure that that information is all correct in keeping, you know, the juvenile defender, as well as the juvenile defender contacting you guys as well, to keep up, you know, with where the child is being placed and where they're living. Because a lot of times, a lot of that information that the Department of Juvenile Justice collects is incorrect. And you guys are an invaluable resource for that information and to keep, you know, the defender knowing where the child is living and being able to contact them easily. Also on the day sheet is called a critical alert section. And that's for kids with mental health issues, suicide issues. And I think that's another invaluable piece of information that you can provide the juvenile defenders to make sure that that information is correct. Sometimes the Department of Juvenile Justice, will put a critical alert that may not necessarily be accurate or correct. And I think that that's something that you guys, having the history with the children, will know that information and be able to let them, the defender, know. The other thing, at the detention hearing, the court must read the police report and determine if there's probable cause. If there is probable cause, and the child will, the state files charges, the child will then enter a plea of not guilty, and usually the public defender is appointed. It should be in almost all the instances of cases that you represent, and meaning a dependency child, the public defender should be appointed. The child should automatically be declared indigent, so that should never be an issue. Also, a lot of times, one of the issues that come up in detention hearings is children that are absconding or considered runaways. The children that, what we think of runaways, is not necessarily the case in the delinquency system. And that's something that I think a lot of these dependent children, I mean, it is an issue because a lot of them do run away that we have, and a lot of the girls we see in the delinquency system are runaways. In absconding for the delinquency purposes, the youth is considered an absconder if they leave the jurisdiction in a clandestine manner. And what the Department of Juvenile Justice Probation Manual means is that the children are hiding or concealing themselves in order to avoid the legal process. And the probation officer must believe that the child is intentionally trying to avoid supervision and legal process. Meaning there has to be an intent by the child that they're intentionally trying to hide from the court. And a lot of these kids, that's not what's going on. We know that they have family issues, that either they're trying to run back home, you know, to be with the parent that they've been removed from, or they're running to another relative, or they're just running away to get away from what their, you know, their issues that they're dealing with. And a simple, the child simply running away or not appearing is not considered absconding. And in the risk assessment, if the child is considered an absconder, it's an automatic 12 points, and the child would, you know, automatically score detention. So that's something that's really, really important. The other thing that, another issue that may arise at detention is the defenders have to advocate for the expressed interest of the child. And I think that sometimes the defenders, and sometimes as GALs, we have to better understand our roles. And I think that a lot of times the juvenile defender, may understand that it's not in the best interest for the child to advocate for whatever it is in court, but they have to. They don't have a choice. And just like you may have to advocate for what the best interest is, even though the child may disagree with you. And I think that by us understanding each other's roles better and respecting each other's roles better, I think it's a better way to find common ground between the defenders and the guardians and the department. So I think that's something that's really important as well. The other thing that we really encourage our defenders is to be prepared for these detention hearings. A detention hearing is a critical, critical time for these children. It determines whether they're going to be locked up and for, 21 days. And I don't think we realize the traumatic impact for some of these children to be locked up and detained and put around other people that may be abusive or other children that may be a lot more serious offenders than them. And I think that it's
we really encourage them to be prepared for these hearings. And I think that you guys, again, are a great resource for the defenders to contact you and get with you. And you guys make yourself available to get that information and get that background information about the child and what's going on. And we encourage them to talk to the kid prior to the detention hearing to have all these options and understand what's going on and talk with the children. So that way, when they come to the detention hearing, they can be prepared and, you know, really give, you know, input. And you guys, if you're able to, and I understand we're all extremely busy and all over in different places, so we can't be in so many places at once. But, you know, you guys are a great resource for the defenders and, you know, to be able to get that information and really use it in the detention hearing. The other thing that we really encourage the defenders to is to provide other alternatives to detention. Even though the child may score detention, there may be a better option. There may be a better mental health facility for the child to go to because they don't need to be in the detention center. They're not going to necessarily get their needs met like we would want their needs met. A lot of times they don't meet their educational needs if they've got the special education. They're not going to end up getting their IEPs followed. They're not going to necessarily get the mental health counseling. And so what would be, you know, great for you guys is to really, you know, assist with providing those alternatives and maybe having better alternatives for the kids rather than being detained. We encourage and, you know, you guys can be a part of, you know, talking about why it would be beneficial for the kid not to be detained. And I understand there are certain circumstances that the child does need to be detained. I mean, there are some serious offenses. But for the most part, for these kids, especially the crossover kids, these kids that are in foster care, they are being re-traumatized. They've already been traumatized for whatever reason, whether it was physical or sexual abuse or verbal abuse. And now these children, you know, or just flat-out abandonment. And a lot of the children, you know, don't need to be detained again and re-suffer any kind of additional trauma by being detained in the detention center. There's a great report out by the Justice Policy Institute that I can, if you want to email me, I've included my email at the end, called The Dangers of Detention and the Impact of Incarcerating Youth. And it's a great, great report talking about how it is not beneficial for these kids to be detained. And I think that you guys are really, a lot of times, the best ones to know what the placement for these kids are. The department, both Department of Juvenile Justice and Department of Children and Families, have motivations behind you know, whether they want these kids locked up or not. And I think that the guardians and the attorney ad litem are both great advocates for these kids to show a placement that's really what is for the best interest for the kid and what their needs really do need to be met. And it's not a matter of how much it's going to cost or, you know, what we need to get the bureaucracy surrounding and what we need to get done. And I think that you guys are the great, great, you know, ones to be able to assist the defenders and knowing what resources are out there and can really, you know, find something that's better for the kid than being detained. The other thing that I've found a lot of times is that these children that are being detained, you know, the Department of Children and Families is not picking up the kids. Some do, some don't. I'm not going to make a bright line rule. But these children, you know, if they're released that day in court, they need to be picked up by 5 o'clock. And, you know, and so what we, you know, encourage our defenders, and when I was a public defender, I told them, you know, if the kid, I'm saying, call me if you don't get, you know, picked up by 4, so at least I can be doing something in that last hour. So it's really just really important. And the other thing that I've found, too, is if a child is detained for 21 days, the department will also, Department of Children and Families, will also wait until the last minute to find a placement. For example, I had a child that I represented, and she was a was charged with poisoning her foster mother. And she was detained for 21 days. And by statute, due to the nature of her charge, they could detain her an additional 9 days. She was 11. And she was under sight and sound. So really, the Department of Juvenile Justice did not want her detained anymore because she had to be separated from the rest of the other girls. And at the 21-day hearing, the department was like, we don't want her, we don't have a place for her, she needs to be detained. And they did a suitability assessment with a doctor who said that they didn't determine whether she qualified for a mental health facility or not. They recommended that she needed to stay in detention and stay within the Department of Juvenile Justice custody. And so the judge indicated she is not going to be detained any longer than this 9 days. I don't have the authority. And the Department of Children and Families was having a stink about it. And so on the 30th day, we come into court and the judge is ready to release her. And again, DCF said, we have no place for her. She needs to be detained. And the court basically ordered the Department of Children and Families to say, by tomorrow, 5 o'clock, she has to be released. And amazingly, the Department of Children and Families was able to get a suitability assessment done within that short 24-hour period of time, and conveniently, she qualified for a mental health residential facility. And they were able to find funds and all that. And so I think that, but it shouldn't take the court to get to that point. And I think that, you know, one thing that we can do at both defenders and the guardians, and the guardian in this case was fabulous in helping her end up, she ended up in a great mental health facility in Oregon. But, I mean, it was, you know, again, you know, it's the fight between DJJ and DCF. Who wants to be responsible? Neither want to be responsible, and neither wants to have to take care of these kids, but unfortunately, it's their responsibility, and I think that both the juvenile defenders and the guardians are a great group to hold DCF accountable and make sure that they are working on getting a placement for these kids and not waiting till last minute, because these children should not be detained any longer than they need to be. And so if for you guys, if you see this possibly becoming an issue, let the juvenile defender know, because we can definitely get a hearing set to make sure that they are going to get released and have a place for the child, rather than it being the child hanging out in the caseworker's office for the day until they can find out what they're going to do with the child. Okay, moving on to other hearings. At arraignment, that's when the court determines whether the child does qualify, whether the state's going forward and proceeding with charges. If the state does file charges, then the child is appointed counsel and the trial day is set. If the child has no prior history, the child may qualify for a diversion program. And these are great programs for kids that can go, and if they have no history, they can, you know, complete these different sanctions, and then the case gets dismissed. One of the problems that I did have in some of my instances is the child was never in any one place long enough for them to complete the diversion program. Or the caseworker, you know, just did not want to have to deal with the child going to the diversion program. And that's not fair for the child. But this is a great opportunity for the child to complete the diversion program, not have this case on their record. And so that's something that I think definitely you can alert the defenders, you know, if that's an issue that you see that is arising, and let them know, because that's definitely not fair to the child. Once a trial date is set, then, as you know, it's a bench trial where the judge is the trier of fact. And unlike adult cases, in juvenile, we don't have convictions. We have findings of delinquency.
So what we do is we, you know, explain to the child when they are applying for, you know, depending upon, you know, college or employment, you know, you haven't been convicted of any crime. You've been found delinquent, which is a huge distinction. And you haven't been arrested. You've been detained. So there's definitely some differences between the adult and juveniles that can make significant differences. The other thing that comes up a lot, with especially with the crossover youth, are competency, whether the child is competent to stand trial and assist their attorney during the trial. The child, what we encourage is the child should be first evaluated confidentially by a psychologist. And the reason for that is the child will make admissions, and we would prefer the child to make those admissions confidentially to a psychologist that the defender has paid for. And if they're found competent, then nobody knows but the defender. If the child is not evaluated confidentially, then all that admissions and other issues, you know, will be revealed to both the court and the state attorney. If the child is found incompetent, then the state will request for, in the one eval, the state then requests the second eval. If the child is found incompetent by two doctors, if it's a misdemeanor, then no services are provided to the child. And then just reviews are set every 6 months with the child being reevaluated to determine if they're still competent or incompetent. If it's a felony, the child is then also committed in this instance to the Department of Children and Families for services, which includes restoration training, which depending upon what, if it's based upon, retardation, then they'll get services for that. If it's based upon mental illness, then they will get services for that. And so it just depends upon what the basis for the incompetency is. I think that, again, an invaluable thing for the defenders is, you know, you guys, the guardians, providing, you know, without, you know, breaching any kind of privacy or confidentiality laws, you know, providing any kind of mental health background information, education records, medical records. A lot of times the defenders will try and get it from the caseworkers, but it's like pulling teeth. And, you know, so the guardians can be a great way to assist the defenders in getting all that individual background information for the purposes of the evaluations. And the doctors really want that information. It's really, really key. And some of your evaluations that are, you know, conducted in the dependency side are so much better than anything that we could get on the delinquency side. And so that's just really, really invaluable. And it's invaluable even not for competency purposes. It's just invaluable to have for the defender to truly understand what's going on with these kids and what they can do to best provide services depending upon the nature of the charge and what the child is facing. Once a child is found either enters a plea of guilty or no contest or is found delinquent at the trial, the court will then set what's called a disposition hearing. We call, in delinquency, call it disposition hearing. You know, for everyone else, it's called sentencing. And what the court will do is he'll order what's called a predisposition report. A predisposition report is about a 5-page report. It's written by the Department of Juvenile Justice, and it will include the child's charges, any kind of family or school background, prior history, including drug or alcohol abuse, any kind of prior criminal history, and the recommendation for the court. When they do request the predisposition report, the child is then to meet with the Department of Juvenile Justice. And DJJ will want to interview the child and the caseworker. But I think that's something that, again, a lot of times doesn't happen, but should be happening, is that the department of Juvenile Justice should be contacting you guys as well and getting your input and feedback on what's going on with the child. We encourage you to, you know, be involved and give them your perspective on what the child really needs.
many times the predisposition reports are cookie cutter, letter of apology, go pick up trash down the street. And that's not what the child needs. The child may really need, you know, substance abuse counseling or mental health counseling or, you know, family counseling. And you guys are really, truly in the best position to know what is, you know, the child really does need. And so, you know, we would really encourage you to be involved in that and give them your perspective. And, or, you know, I know you're all really busy, but, you know, maybe even, you know, typing out a report, you know, in your position on what the child should be getting, you know, sentenced to, you know, that can be then attached to the predisposition report. The judges really weigh heavily your opinion. A lot of times, you know, they see you guys as knowing what's really going on in the whole picture. And I think that, you know, the defenders can argue till they're blue in the face, and the state can argue till they're blue in the face. But I think that, you know, when you are able to come in to these disposition hearings and truly give your feedback on what is the best for the child, I think the judges really respect you guys. And I think that they, you know, definitely want to hear your opinion. And lastly, in the predisposition report, this, you know, as I said, the, you know, DJJ will give a recommendation. Again, you know, we really want you to be there. If you can attend the disposition hearing, that would be wonderful. Again, like I said, please, if you can, you know, give your input and make sure that what the needs of the child are and what they're getting is really recommended. The, you know, we feel that commitment should really be the last resort for these kids, and especially the crossover kids. These kids that, you know, you represent and that we represent in the dependency and the delinquency are really best served to get their services met through the Department of Children and Families. The mental health counseling that you're able to get through the Department of Children and Families, the family counseling, the services that are provided through DCF are much, much better than what's being able to be offered through DJJ. And the services, unfortunately, in a lot of these commitment programs are inconsistent. They, you know, they have constant rotation by the counselors in these commitment programs. A lot of these kids are moved constantly from commitment program to commitment program, so they're not getting the stability that these kids really do need. And so, you know, for us, and when I was a public defender, I mean, for me, it was crucial to really get the, you know, as a condition of probation, what the services through DCF were, rather than getting the kid committed. And so, you know, that was really just really, really, really crucial. The other thing that, you know, I observed is, you know, it was, again, like I said, the fight between DJJ versus DCF. Who wants to have to pay for this kid? You know, DJJ doesn't want the kid in a commitment program because they're going to have to pay for them. DCF doesn't want to have the kid out in the community because that's one more child they're responsible for. And I think a lot of times the caseworkers, I mean, we're all busy. We all have huge caseloads. And I think a lot of times for the caseworkers, it's one less case that I need to worry about if they're committed and I don't have to deal with them for 6 to 8 months. But again, for these kids that are in foster care, it is crucial that these kids do not go to a commitment program. I mean, again, I understand there's always exceptions to the rule, but I think for the large majority of these crossover youth, I think it's really just invaluable for these kids to, you know, get the services through the Department of Children and Families rather than DJJ, because the services are just not good in the commitment programs. The other thing that I found that I really appreciated the Guardians was that you provided an independent viewpoint for my kid. For instance, I had a number of cases that, you know, just horrible family dynamics. The mom would be, you know, have serious mental health issues. You know, child is claiming mom has mental health issues, but no one's believing him. And I think that something that was really critical for us and the Guardians, and this was before, you know, the Guardians did not take delinquency unless there was a dependency case. But, I mean, I think that it was great for me to have a guardian on my case to say, yes, mom does have mental health issues, and it's not just the kids saying this. And I think that, you know, again, the guardians are invaluable to provide that independent viewpoint to the core as to what's really going on with this child and what's really going on in the home and what the child is facing. And again, you know, as I've reiterated before, I mean, I think that you guys are a great resource for the defenders. You guys have so much information that they don't have access to. And any way that you can assist them, you know, in helping the kid, which is just invaluable. We don't, you know, it's very hard for us to get that information. And especially, you've developed a rapport with the child. You've developed a relationship with them. And I think that the child, a lot of times, will trust you, you know, and is willing to give you information. You know, they may have met me as their public defender for 5 minutes before court, and maybe in, you know, an hour or two on another day. And that's not any way to build a relationship. But unfortunately, life as the juvenile defender, is that's how it is. And I think that, you know, one way that, you know, to build just that rapport between the child and the defender is, you know, to you know, have that connection with the guardian and use you guys as a great resource and a connection to the child. And so, with that said, does anybody have any questions?
Carrie, maybe you mentioned this, but one thing we have a problem with is getting the caseworkers to bring the child to, like, the public defender's office in advance to meet with the child. And so when you mentioned, I think a lot of times the kids in foster care do only meet their attorney right before court. So right. Do you see that as something we can help with by making sure they get in to see their attorney in advance?
Yes. I think that that's a wonderful thing. I think that some that could be put in a court order. I mean, I think it's something as simple as, you know, especially if you, you know, if you see, you know, there, unfortunately, there are certain caseworkers that, you know, it's a consistent problem with. And, you know, I think that something, I mean, the court will a lot of times at arraignment say, with the parent, you must bring your child and set up an appointment with the public defender. So I don't know why that could not be in a court order with the caseworker. It shouldn't be any different. I mean, they're the parent or guardian of the child, so I don't see why that should make any different. And I think that if it is a consistent problem, that's something that definitely alerts, you know, the defender to know, and that way they can, you know, make sure that's in the court order and really hold their feet to the fire on that. And I think that it's a problem, I know at least because my husband is a juvenile public defender, it's just even bringing the child to court is a problem. And then the child has been forced, you know, the court says, well, waiver of speedy trial, which is not appropriate either, and that's not the child's fault. And I think that that's another issue that I think the guardian can really help, you know, assist and make sure that that doesn't happen as well. Any other questions? Concerns? Comments? No?
Hi, this is Hillary in the fourth.
Hi.
Hi, you had mentioned the risk assessment, and if they score 0 to 6, they get straight release. You said there was a case out that says that they can't put restrictions on that release. Do you have the citation or even the case name on that? Because we run into that all the time here.
Yeah, there are some general conditions like no contact with the victim or no contact with the co-defendant.
But the big ones are like, you must go to school every day.
Yep, without
any
of
the household rules. Yeah, they're not supposed to be doing that. The only way they can do that is if the child scores detention and the judge is being nice and releasing them anyway. Then they can impose those conditions.
Okay.
But if the child scores 0 to 6, they are not supposed to be doing that.
But our judges have this thing called counselor's release, where they release the child back to DCF.
Yeah.
And they put those conditions on.
Yeah, no. My email is at the end. If you want to email me, I can send you the case law.
Oh, that would be
but
wonderful.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, not a problem. Anybody else? Well, I thank you, and we are here, the Juvenile Justice Center is here for you guys anytime as a resource. You know, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to call us or email me. We also provide we do 2 live seminars, and this June 18th, we're doing a seminar on adolescent development and communicating with children. And what else? Collateral consequences for children and competency as far as waiving Miranda. You know, you guys are welcome to attend. It's free. We don't charge anything. It's going to be in St. Pete Beach. So if that's something that you guys are interested in, you know, coming for a part of or would like the material for, Dr. Randy Otto out of Tampa is going to be teaching one of the sessions, so I'm really excited. And then we've got some national speakers as well coming. So, I mean, we, you know, it's going to be more delinquency-based, you know, but you're welcome to attend any of our seminars. If you're interested, email me that information. And otherwise, thank you very much, and I appreciate all that you're doing. I know it's, you know, with budgets the way they are, we're all trying to do the most we can with the little that we have, so.
Yeah, thank you so much.